It is war in Lebanon. Israel has bombed thousands of targets as it shifts its focus now to getting its northern citizens back home. Russia has a brand new secret drone project. And there's some apparent good news in U.S. crime statistics. We'll take a closer look on today's Trumpet World. Welcome back to Trumpet World. It's finally happened. All summer, Mihailo Zekic and I have talked about, well, is this it? Is Israel going after Hezbollah now? It was clear the current situation couldn't continue. Imagine if all U.S. citizens in Washington and Oregon had to leave their homes because their towns and cities were under constant rocket attack. Israel put up with that situation while it focused on dealing with the more immediate problem with Hamas in Gaza. Now they're really dealing with Hezbollah. So I'm joined by Mihailo Zekic, who can get us up to speed and give us the latest update on this story.
Yes, there's been quite a few dramatic escalations in this just in the past week. On September 20th, there was a meeting with the elite corps of, or the officer corps of the Radwan Force, that's Hezbollah's special forces in Beirut, including Ibrahim Akil, who was the leader of the group, and for some people around back then to remember it, was partly responsible for the 1983 bombing in Beirut that killed over 240 U.S. servicemen. Israel got wind of the meeting and took them out in an airstrike, which basically decapitated the Radwan Force's leadership. This, of course, comes on the heels of the pager walkie-talkies attack that we talked about. So part of the reason some people think that this meeting was going on was because Hezbollah didn't trust its communication devices anymore. So they decided, let's do what we've been doing for 2,000 years before technology advanced and meet face-to-face. And that apparently even isn't safe anymore. So Hezbollah is getting really insecure of their communications lines, their organization structure.
And they don't have much leadership left.
Yeah, they don't. And that obviously the attacks from Israel continued on the 21st, where almost 300 projectiles came in and took out some of the projectile infrastructure that Hezbollah has with rockets and missiles, whatever. On the 25th, they expanded it to over 2,000 targets, and including 70 intelligence centers. And some analysts suspect this may have shrunk Hezbollah's capability to attack Israel with rockets and missiles by about 50%. So you lose all, you lose the communications lines, you lose the leadership, and now you lose the actual tools that they use to fight. So at this point, Hezbollah is looking pretty headless, and Israel and Hezbollah obviously have been having these kinds of attacks for a while now. As you mentioned, we've been talking about this since the summer. Why this dramatic escalation right at this point? Well, if you don't have your communications line secure, if you don't have people to give orders, it makes a pretty vulnerable army for an invasion. And on the 25th, we got the closest sign yet that Israel is going into Lebanon.
So Israel's hit over 2,000 targets. I think it was Monday or Tuesday, 500 dead, the deadliest day for Lebanon since the end of their civil war at the start of the 1990s. A very dramatic attack, much more so than the strikes that we've had from Israel that have been ongoing since October 7th. This was on a much higher scale. Now, there's been all kinds of discussion, accusations of them hitting civilian targets. The IDF released video footage demonstrating that Hezbollah was storing missiles in people's homes or in attics and civilian infrastructure. And Israel took out a lot of these weapons. How do you have a good feel for how much of Hezbollah's capability has been taken out in those kind of strikes?
The Israeli government is estimating it could be as high as 50%.
I guess it depends, 50% of the arsenal, like what type? Because Hezbollah has the much bigger long-range missiles, almost like cruise missiles type of capability that Hamas doesn't have.
Well, plenty of those have been eradicated, but I mean, even if you take 50% of, like, the U.S. estimates that Hezbollah had about 150,000 rockets at the start of the war, like, that's still thousands of, like, various types anyway. So just because things have been reduced, that doesn't necessarily mean that all's in the clear. Like, if war were to break out today, Hezbollah still has well more than enough to turn Tel Aviv into rubble and overwhelm Iron Dome doing it. So it's, even though Hezbollah's capability has been reduced, that doesn't mean it's any less dangerous.
So we haven't seen the maximum that full-scale war could look like yet. Now, I guess then after that, the discussion has shifted to Israel. Is Israel going to send in ground troops? The tempo of the missile attacks has decreased since earlier this week. I think there still are Israeli strikes, but not on that same scale. Do you think Israel's going to send in ground forces next?
Well, I don't have to think anything. They've said as much. On the 25th, Herzi Halevi, who's the Israeli Defense Forces chief of staff, the IDF released a video of him visiting soldiers on the northern front and Halevi was talking to them, and he openly said, "You guys are going into Lebanon." I could quote that from the film they released. "Your military boots will enter enemy territory. Enter villages that Hezbollah has prepared as large military outposts with underground infrastructure, staging points, and launch pads into our territory to carry out attacks on Israeli civilians. Your entry into those areas with force, your encounter with Hezbollah operatives, will show them what it means to face a professional, highly skilled, and battle-experienced force." End quote. If your chief of staff is going to say that for the whole world to see, I think that's as good of a sign as you can get.
Or it could be a threat.
It could be.
We want to make it look like we're going to send in ground troops to try and get Hezbollah to back down. So I think it is still possible for both sides to step away from the brink. So ground invasion could be on the cards. One of the really interesting things I think we saw this week is also Iran's response from some of the other countries potentially mobilizing to combat an Israeli response on some other fronts.
Yes. Now, a little caveat, we don't really have many details on what all this means. We're working with the bare bones, but Haaretz on the 24th reported that roughly 40,000 militia members, soldiers, terrorists, whatever you want to call them, have grouped together from Iraq, from Yemen, and even from Syria itself on Syria's border with the Golan Heights in Israel, apparently waiting for Hassan Nasrallah, the leader of Hezbollah, to give them the go-ahead to join the fray with Israel. A lot of people estimate Hezbollah's fighting force in general to be about 50,000 people. So this is almost doubling the number of people that would be fighting with Israel if a northern war were to break out in active warfare. And also, this would also mean the front fighting would open up in a new front in Syria. And Bashar Assad's very reluctant to enter the fray. He'll obviously let Iran use his territory. He'll let Hezbollah use his territory. But with his actual military, unless if there are Israeli boots on the ground, he tries to stay out of the fighting as much as possible. If this were to happen, this would be a game changer, and Assad probably couldn't deal with that any longer. And the sources that Haaretz cited said that if push comes to shove, we're going to let Assad know we're not going to tolerate these people on our border. So Assad may not even really be able to make a choice. Israel might make the choice for him.
So we could be seeing a threat then against Israel, potentially in the Golan Heights, which has been less involved in this conflict than other parts of Israel that more directly border Lebanon. And this is, an unconfirmed report from Haaretz. There was a strike on the port city of Eilat that came from one of these Iraqi militia groups this week. So we do have actual attacks that are coming from these Iraqi militia groups.
Well, they themselves have said that if active fighting breaks out, we're pouring over the border.
And for a long time, we've been saying, all the way since the 1990s, Iraq is going to fall to Iran. And that's happened. And the news this week just really drove home to me the implications of that. That you just need to get a map out, and Iraq falling to Iran brings Iran a whole lot closer to Israel. It reduces that strike distance a lot. And so whether or not we see these troops get involved, whether or not we see a ground invasion, I think this shows the power that having Iran, having free movement of its militia all over Iraq, what that gives them in their ability to strike Israel. Maybe they won't use that power to the full this time, but there's coming a time where they will.
Yes, as you said, this is not even on the same threat level as what Hamas did on October 7th. I mean, as bad as that was, we haven't seen the kind of tank-to-tank carnage that maybe could have happened because of the war in Gaza, but didn't. Iran, for its part, has been trying to restrain Hezbollah for the past few months on giving Israel an excuse to start this bigger war, because they know that Israel is tired of Hezbollah and they have the will to get rid of Hezbollah. At this point, Hezbollah has been Iran's number one insurance policy, I guess you could say, against Israel with all those rockets. Like, if you behave badly, we can overwhelm Iron Dome, etc. And Israel is going after basically the root of the problem in Lebanon, at least, and neutralizing that insurance policy. If war were to break out between Israel and Hezbollah, for first off, Halevi, for his part, suggested it's going to be, within the border communities to get rid of that infrastructure. If the IDF makes it that far, there's not going to be much stopping them from going all the way to Beirut and getting rid of Hezbollah once and for all. And Iran knows that. And if war breaks out, could we see Iran escalate its own involvement and start mass sending in people to help in Hezbollah? Could we see Assad do that? I don't know. Could we see those thousands and thousands of rockets being sent over to try and overwhelm Iron Dome? There's a decent chance it probably will happen if Hezbollah has nothing left to lose. This is, if war were to break out with the way everybody's expecting, this is probably going to be more similar to the Yom Kippur War in 1973, where you do see actual professional armies clashing with each other and some of these big battlefields or battles that we may be accustomed to in places like Ukraine, but hasn't really happened in Israel yet. So even if Israel decides to launch this war because they have this public support, because they have the will, because they know they can win, that doesn't mean it's going to come out of this unscarred.
That is a good point. And we don't yet know. Israel may still try and accomplish all of their goals through an air war. They just want to get to the point where they can send their people home, they can move back into their houses, and the north is secure. And perhaps the threat of invasion and the aerial bombardments will be enough to get Hezbollah to stop the rockets, and maybe things will calm down. Maybe we will be, there's a whole range of kind of scales that we could see this go over. But what we do know for sure is where this is heading in the not too distant future. And you had a trumpet brief that we sent out last night. If you're not subscribed to our mailing list, you can go to our website. We have a trumpet brief email where we send out a daily news blast in the morning to try and get you caught up with the big pieces of news for the day. We have a more deeper email that goes out in the evening. Mihailo's went out yesterday, and I thought your conclusion to that really did give a great overview of the broad sweep of Bible prophecy and showed how this really does tie into, okay, yes, several specifics, but also just into the big picture. So could you summarize that for us now?
Yes. So a prophecy we go to regularly to analyze what's going on in the Middle East and with radical Islam is Daniel 11 verse 40, which talks about two end time power blocks, a king of the south and a king of the north clashing. Verse 41 says that this revolves around the glorious land or the holy land. It revolves around the land that's being fought right now. And since the 1990s, our editor-in-chief has pointed to the king of the south being radical Islam, led by Iran, but including its proxy empire, and the king of the north, which is a German-led European power that actually, at least at first, appears to be helping out the Israelis and being on their side. What does this have to do with Syria and Lebanon? Well, another prophecy in Psalm 83, which refers to Asher or Assyria, the ancient peoples of Germany, and an alliance they make that has never happened in history, which is how we know it's a prophecy. It refers to different Middle Eastern groups joining Assyria, joining the king of the north, and these include the Hagarenes, which are the ancient peoples of Syria, and Gebel or Byblos, and Tyre, which are to this day still cities in Lebanon. And because of that, our editor-in-chief, Mr. Fleury, has pointed to Lebanon and Syria at some point leaving the Iranian camp and joining the German camp, joining, I guess you could say, the more western side of the two. And going back to Daniel 11, I mentioned its proxy empire. You go to verses 42 and 43, and it talks about some of those countries that will be allied with Iran, Egypt, Libya, Ethiopia. All of them are to the south of Israel. Iran's main focus at this point with Lebanon, with Syria, is to the north. Iran right now, it has some tentacles in Africa. It wouldn't say it's its main priority, though. Something's going to have to, at some point, shift in the Iranian thinking to see that there's nothing they could do in the north and they have to try and attack Israel another way. At least with the way things are going right now, it does look like both Hezbollah and the Assad regime will at least have some sort of major shakeups relating to the current war somehow.
Yeah, that's a nice summary of the broad overview where Iran will be moved out of Lebanon and Syria, and the trends that we're seeing right now could well form a part of that. And I wanted to bring in kind of the Europe section as my main story here as well, because part of those same prophecies is that Europe moves in. and that Lebanon and Syria, these are specifically, as we've talked about, allied with Europe. Bible prophecy lists these guys in Psalm 83 as being part of the European alliance. So we're watching for a change there. That's something that could emerge from what we're seeing. And this week, we've already seen Europe get involved. We've already seen statements from the Pope where he has condemned Israel's airstrikes or spoken out against the level of bloodshed. We've seen France come forwards and put across or try to push a ceasefire. The big ceasefire deal this week was really, it was the United States and France that were the main drivers behind this push for a ceasefire. And then the European Union within the UN Security Council has been pushing for a UN Security Council demanding a peace in this area. So far, the United States has said that they will block that. That's been the sticking point. I don't know how long that will last, but you see the real potential for Europe to get involved here. And this Deutsche Welle had an article this week, Can Europe Help Contain Spiraling Violence in Lebanon? And they pointed out just the unique position that France is in here, where Lebanon is a former French colony. There are thousands of Lebanese citizens that are French passport holders, that you already have French troops involved in the region, in the United Nations interim force in Lebanon, where they're there on the Lebanon-Israel border. Reuters talked about that earlier this year, Paris had been pushing a ceasefire proposal between Israel and Hezbollah. And it ties in with France's domestic politics too. And Deutsche Welle points this out as well, where they're in a mess at home. There's a divided parliament. It's making it very hard for them to have any kind of domestic program, radical domestic policy. French President Emmanuel Macron wants to do something. He's coming to the end of his tenure. He wants something to kind of go down in history with. Can't do it at home, but he still, as president, has control of all of the foreign policy, military policy. Something in Lebanon, a very bold French step in Lebanon, could be exactly what he needs for his legacy right now. And can distract from his own domestic political squabbles and troubles going on at home. So that might, we could see France step up even more than they have already. But I think the other part of this that is an important part of this story is these efforts from some of these major European players do tilt away from Israel. They're pretty biased towards Hezbollah. I mean, we saw this with Emmanuel Macron after the pages, where he came out and said, what was it? I stand with Lebanon. Do you remember? Was that exactly what he said?
Something to that effect. I don't remember the exact words.
Yeah. So there was nothing about, well, Hezbollah's been bombing Israeli towns and cities, nothing about the children that were killed in that strike on a football field from Hezbollah. For the Pope, it was similar. Lots of people pointed out this was a very one-sided statement that he put out, and kind of really did cast Israel as the bad guy and didn't really show much or any empathy with Israel's position and the troubles that they were facing. That shows this dynamic that we've been forecasting in Bible prophecy as well, where you could see Europe being involved in some fashion in what's going on right now. Who knows? Maybe it's some kind of dramatic ceasefire agreement that sees European troops in the ground as peacekeepers to guarantee that Hezbollah doesn't keep firing rockets. Maybe there's a much bigger Yom Kippur-style war, and then as part of the geopolitical shifts that happen after that, with a de-Iranicized Syria and a de-Iranicized Lebanon, while Israel then, and then Europe then moves in. But however that plays out, this is an absolutely key prophecy that we're watching for as well. For Iran to move out of that area and for Europe to move in. And about 10 years ago, Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury had an article, Why You Need to Watch Lebanon. And in that article, he said, because of its high population of Christian Arabs, Lebanon has become a linchpin for the Psalm 83 alliance. And so then when you see France stepping up and saying, hey, we'll negotiate a ceasefire between Israel and Lebanon and pushing this UN Security Council to step in and do something. And European newspapers saying, well, France is in a unique position to go into Lebanon and solve this. And then when you see the Pope speaking out on Lebanon, and then just yesterday, the Latin Patriarch of Jerusalem, the kind of local Catholic representative there, put out a statement calling for a day of prayer and fasting on the anniversary of October 7th. When you see the Catholic Church getting more involved in this area, we're watching this happen. And it's important to keep watching what is happening here, that this is going to be the linchpin of Europe's involvement in this region. And I think we've heard a lot from Mr. Flurry as well, just even the last year, on why you should watch Syria as well, and watch for Germany to get involved in Syria. Germany has a lot of Syrian refugees. There's a lot of German politicians that have talked about, well, even for our own domestic policy reasons, we need to make sure Syria is stabilized so we can send these Syrian refugees home. Crisis in this area will bring those discussions to the fore. So this could, as well as accelerating this Iranian shift to the south, could really accelerate Europe getting involved in this particular area. I think even the presence of Iranian militia in Iraq and the way that they're stepping up, this could bring Jordan into play. You know, Jordan is kind of under threat from Iran right now, and they're also directly between Iraq and Israel. And if Iraqi militia wants to move into Israel and open up another front that's not in the north of Israel, and if these Iranian militia want to move through and get to, say, the West Bank, Jordan's in the way. This could lead to more European involvement to stabilize Jordan. So I think this is what I really liked about that article that you published last night is, it was the forest picture. It wasn't just the details and the trees, but I think it really did give us a great overview of what the Bible says is happening, and shows how the events on the ground just really are right in line with that overview. The Bible gives us just an incredible depth of understanding for what is going on in the Middle East. And you know, we've mentioned a few different articles. If you want to look those up, fantastic. Those articles will give you a great insight on some of those specifics, and we'll link to some of them in our show notes. But your best one-stop shop to understanding the Middle East is our book, The King of the South. It is an excellent entry point for just understanding Bible prophecy generally. It's written really aimed at somebody with no background knowledge, and it will take you up to speed to on these broad trends of what the Bible says is to come in the Middle East. It will show you how so many of these just little specific statements, individual words in the Bible are packed with meaning and explain what is happening today, explain the strategies of Iranian generals in their bunkers, what European policymakers are really thinking right now. So that book will explain the Middle East, but more importantly, that book will bring the Bible to life. So be really happy to send you that book, The King of the South. You can get that on our website. And it's all of these different events in the Middle East tie into that. And I believe, Mihaly, you've got a few more that you want to bring to us.
Yeah, well, one more. And I'm going to talk about something I don't normally talk about on this segment, and that's social media. On Sunday, Donald Trump posted an interesting statement on his Truth Social account. Quote, "It was great seeing my friends, His Highness Sheikh Tamim bin Hamad Al Thani, Amir of Qatar, and His Excellency Sheikh Mohammed bin Abdulrahman bin Jassim Al Thani, Prime Minister of Qatar, at Mar-a-Lago in Palm Beach, Florida. The Emir has proven to be a great and powerful leader of his country, advancing on all levels at record speed. He is someone also who strongly wants peace in the Middle East and all over the world. We had a great relationship during my years in the White House, and it will be even stronger this time around," end quote. So, according to Trump, the two main leaders of Qatar visited him in Mar-a-Lago. Aside from that post, that's the only record we have of this happening at all. As far as we know, they didn't visit Biden on the way. They actually went to the United States, visited Trump, and got out without any media coverage popping out covering him. Whatever was happening here looks like was more low impromptu and with Trump, not with the actual governing government of the United States right now. So aside from the fact that it would be a snub on Biden's part, the fact that I wanted to zone in a little bit was Trump talking about him wanting peace in the Middle East strongly. Qatar is probably, next to Iran, the biggest sponsor of Hamas, to the point where most of the top leadership, at least before Sinwar was elected leader, was living in Qatar. That's where Ismail Haniyeh was. That's where Halal Mashal is. And somehow, even before the election happens, the leadership of Qatar is going to Trump, not to Biden, but to Trump secretly to talk apparently about peace in the Middle East. We know that Trump has been talking a lot about already formulating a peace plan for Ukraine and how he's going to solve the war like overnight once he gets reelected. He's talked a lot about the war in Israel as well and how he supports Israel. He wants Israel to get the job done. And in this case, he's even talking to one of Hamas's main bankrollers before he's even president. This may indicate that he may even actually have something going on in the works and is possibly getting Qatar on his side. Qatar is getting a little bit fed up with Hamas. They've recently moved or started a headquarters in Iraq, and there's rumors that they might relocate everything over there. But the reason that this stood out to me was in 2022, when there was an electoral crisis in Israel and America was still going through its never-ending political problems, Mr. Fleury analyzed a passage in 2 Kings 14, verses 26 and 28, about a man named Jeroboam, who we know from other prophecies is a prophetic parallel to somebody we're expecting in this end time to come and save Israel from bitter affliction and from being blotted out, that in a book we quote often, The United States and Britain in Prophecy says, that also includes the United States and other countries as well. But specifically in verse 28, it mentions Jeroboam recovering something for Judah, for what we would call the state of Israel today. And what Mr. Fleury wrote in that article in 2022 is, quote, "The indication is that Jeroboam reclaimed something to help Judah, the Jewish nation. It appears Mr. Trump may have to recover some of Judah's freedom," end quote. He's not even in office yet, and already he's talking with one of the other sides of the conflict, potentially bringing something in that could help Israel out in a major way. Again, aside from that True Social post, nobody would know anything about this, so the details are murky, but you could already see him moving in that direction in big ways before he's even elected.
Well, thank you for that, Mihailo. And just before we take a break, I'll just give you a rundown of a few important stories from Europe. The first is that the far-right Alternative für Deutschland party narrowly missed out on yet another victory in Brandenburg's state election. Brandenburg is a social democratic party stronghold. If they had lost that, it could have been a massive deal for German politics. Ahead of the elections, people were saying if the Social Democrats lose, and the polls indicated they could, that it could bring down the government, that the Chancellor Olaf Scholz might feel like he has to resign, we could be facing fresh German federal elections. They just squeaked out a victory. So the Social Democrats won 30.7% of the vote. The Alternative for Deutschland won 29.5%. So squeezing into first place there. There'll probably be a coalition with this party of Sarah Wagenknecht, this new party that split off from the left party, this kind of far left. It's called the left party. It's a far left party. And so that's just the latest election to really show the appetite for radical change within Germany, to have the Social Democrats come so close to losing in their stronghold. Similar sign of that, you had the leaders of the Green Party step down this week. The Green Party is part of the governing coalition. Now, the leaders of the Green Party are different to kind of the Green Party's chancellor candidate. They do that a little bit differently. The Green Party's chancellor candidate is still in place and got a fairly influential position within the government. But the Green Party has stepped down. Their leaders have stepped down. They're going to vote for new leadership. I mean, they're really feeling the pressure of having been in coalition and lost a lot of popularity. And I think a good chunk of that is that all across the world, people are seeing the cost of a lot of green policies. We see it here in the UK. I think people see it in America. It's no different in Germany. Some of these things, they're marketed as being wonderful. It's going to create jobs. There's going to be no downsides. And then they get implemented and reality sets in very quickly. So they're struggling, the Greens in Germany, but I think, again, that's just going to lead to this appetite, understandably so, for something very different. And Austria is heading to the polls this weekend. They've got their chancellor elections, their federal elections. This could be very interesting. There they have the Freedom Party of Austria, the FPÖ. It's an O with two dots. But they're a fringe right party. And then it's basically a toss up who's going to win, whether it's this kind of fringe right party or the more mainstream right party. They're almost neck and neck. It seems almost certain that the result will be a coalition between these two, the next government. But who's going to be the leader of the coalition? It's probably going to be whichever one of these parties gets the most seats. So we're seeing all of these European different countries struggle to deal with this fringe element in politics. You see more and more people completely understandably fed up with the status quo. Watch for that to transform Europe and bring it in a very different direction. And right now we're working on our next Trumpet print edition. This Trumpet print edition is all about exactly this trend in Europe, this dilemma of the rise of the fringe. How do you deal with it? How do you deal with it when the mainstream parties have been so terrible? Do you vote for these upstart parties? What is the solution? We've got quite a lot of articles that engage with that topic. All right, we'll take a quick break, and when we get back, we'll look at the latest news from Asia and the United States. Welcome back to Trumpet World. On Wednesday's show, we talked about secret agents from Iran infiltrating the US State Department and even the White House. Well, for this segment, we're going to look at a secret war drones project, perhaps something that sounds even more sinister than secret agents, that Russia has underway. And we're going to hear more about that from Jeremiah Jacques.
Thank you, Mr. Palmer. Yes, this is a secret project just revealed this week. And it is that Russia is producing attack drones in a factory inside of China. So one of the big developments of Russia's war on Ukraine, at least in terms of technology, has been seeing unmanned aerial vehicles or drones become extremely important on the battlefields, or you could say in the skies above those battlefields. Attack drones generally cost just a small fraction of the price of a warplane or an attack helicopter, and they don't have a pilot inside risking his life in order to attack the enemy, and they're able to do tremendous amounts of damage on enemy positions. Michael Kaufman is a leading military analyst, and he recently said, quote, "Drones give countries cheap access to tactical aviation and precision-guided weapons, allowing them to destroy the enemy's much more expensive equipment," end quote. So, you know, F-35s and J-20s and other fifth-generation fighter jets and warplanes, they're not obsolete by any means. Those kinds of advanced aircraft are still capable of a lot that drones are not able to do. But those kinds of warplanes are just exorbitantly expensive, and drone technology is advancing fast. And it's being combined, of course, with AI. And all of this is changing some deep-rooted dynamics that have really defined war for decades. And it's blunting the edge a little bit of these billion-dollar F-35s and J-20s and other high-tech planes. So there's a big shift underway here, and China is on the forefront of this shift in many ways with their drone manufacturing. And the revelation this week shows that China is helping Russia to develop and even flight test a new attack drone called the Gerpaya 3. The Gerpaya 3 is extremely powerful. It can carry a payload of 110 pounds. That's a massive amount of explosives that these can deliver to their targets. And the range of these is also remarkable. They can travel 1,200 miles. The details of this it's all based on European intelligence that's just been disclosed and reported by Reuters. And it shows that Chinese specialists are assisting with this whole Russian project. China is helping Russia to mass produce these in a factory inside of China. And that's invaluable to the Russians because, of course, right now we have Western sanctions that make it very difficult for Russia to get a lot of microchips and other advanced components that are needed for drones. But those sanctions don't apply in China. So that's just a massive victory for Russia to be able to build these advanced weapons in a non-sanctioned partner country. And these will be somewhat like the Iranian suicide drones that Russia's been using so many of over the last 2 years to kill Ukrainians. But this new drone that Russia is making with China is considerably more powerful than the Iranian ones and has a longer range as well. So this shows us that China is increasingly ignoring laws that ban countries from helping Russia, giving Russia lethal aid. And it shows that China's support of Russia is becoming more and more valuable to the Russian war machine.
That really does sound pretty brazen of China. When America is doing so much to say, well, if you support Russia in this war effort, we're going to sanction you. We're going to come after you with some of these sanctions and things like that. I mean, China, by doing this, is kind of sending a message to the world. We're not afraid of American sanctions. We don't think they're actually going to do it. We think we're too big to be sanctioned. We actually think America needs us more than we need them. And we're not afraid of American economic warfare.
That's a very big part of this story, for sure. Yeah, to see China really kind of publicly flouting these laws. And of course, China, the government denies official involvement. They say perhaps this is happening, but it's a private Chinese company and we didn't know about it. So that's the line from the Chinese Communist Party. But the thing is, though, inside of China, pretty much every company is beholden to the Chinese Communist Party. And the laws there make it very clear that companies have to do the government's bidding. And so I think it's extremely unlikely that a private company would be doing this without not just knowledge from the Chinese Communist Party, but probably even instructions from them.
So it shows how little China fears America, and also shows how much China's willing to stick their neck out for Russia. Like, we've been talking, it feels like this relationship between Russia and China comes up on this show almost every week. And this seems like one of the most powerful examples of that we've seen.
Yes, I agree. And the trumpet, we keep a very close eye on this deepening cooperation between Russia and China. And that's because it aligns with Bible prophecy. We have an article, it's called Why the Trumpet Watches Russia Allying with China. This article takes a careful look at passages in Ezekiel and Daniel and Matthew and Revelation and other biblical books. And these passages show that Russia and China will soon be allied along with other Asian nations, and they'll have the largest military force in human history. And these passages show that this massive Asian confederacy will play a central role in World War III. So when we see China right now ignoring Western sanctions in order to arm Russia, I think that demonstrates that this Russia-China axis, it's basically here. It has arrived. And that article that I mentioned, Why the Trumpet Watches Russia Allying with China, it examines those various Bible passages, and it also examines current events such as this drone story, and it shows how this is all moving forward. So I think that it could be a very good read for anyone who would like to understand this in that big picture context.
Well, thank you very much for that. And it helps you understand just about all Asian news in this big picture context. And of course, you've got quite a few other stories that you wanted to give a brief mention to.
Yes, that's right. First of all, a couple of Russia stories. Russia released a draft proposal on Monday showing that it'll be boosting military spending to 40% of the state budget starting in January. So 40% of the state budget, a really eye-popping figure there, and that does equate to 6.2% of Russia's GDP. So some very chilling numbers just showing that Russia's priority increasingly is military dominance and spending enough to ensure military dominance. And then we also got more nuclear threats from Russia this week. Vladimir Putin said, from now on, if any country attacks Russia, even if it's just with conventional weapons, as long as that country is backed by a country that has nuclear weapons, that might be enough for Putin's Russia to strike back with nuclear weapons. So the published nuclear doctrine from a country like Russia and from a man like Putin probably means very little. The truth is he'll do whatever he wants, whenever he wants, without publishing his plans for the world to see. And we have heard Russia threaten nuclear Armageddon numerous times since this war began, pretty much anytime things are not going well for the Russians, which is the case right now. So it's almost certainly just bluster and saber rattling, just an attempt to keep nations like Britain from allowing Ukraine to use certain missiles on targets inside of Russia. But that being said, when you're talking about these unfathomably destructive nuclear weapons, almost certainly is not enough to be comforting. You know, the stakes are just so high that these kind of threats really can't be ignored. And so I think that this move could help achieve Putin's goal of keeping the West from letting Ukraine use certain weapons to hit targets in Russia.
And we've also talked before about how much this kind of rhetoric, these kind of threats from Vladimir Putin affect Europe. And this does, I think it does two things. Like, it raises this climate of fear in Europe and leads to Europe investing more in its military. We're seeing that all across Europe. We're seeing more and more countries. There was one this week, I can't remember which one. Someone was talking about ending conscription. You know, they're beefing up their military. But then also, like, this is a huge factor in the German politics story that I was talking about earlier. Like, a big part of the reason why the Social Democrats nearly lost their election was because of this other left-wing party, the Party of Sarah Wagenknecht, that wants good relations with Russia, that says, look, we don't want nuclear war with Russia. Why are we nuclear? Like, why are we at the point where we're getting Russia threatening us with nuclear weapons? We need to be in their good books. So it's playing a major role in, I think, both the military and the political transformation of Europe. So definitely an important story to keep an eye on. But sorry, you had some other things you wanted to bring us.
Yes, that's right. Next up, a quick one about China increasingly bullying the Philippines in the South China Sea and in the portion of it that is called the West Philippine Sea. On Tuesday, China had 251 vessels inside this area that belongs to the Philippines. This was a massive mix of ships from the Chinese Coast Guard, the PLA Navy, and the Maritime Militia. And it added up to 251 of these altogether, which is just a huge number. And that is an unprecedented number as well. They've never had this many vessels there at once. And it's all just to try to bully the Philippines and intimidate them and to try to force the Philippines into surrendering its maritime territory to China. There is no use of force this time, but we have seen China throwing all kinds of temper tantrums in this area lately, just being a neighborhood bully, demanding that the world let it have exclusive control over the entire South China Sea. And with a show of force like this one this week, we see how much of a tinderbox this region is becoming. And then I wanted to sneak in one more quick China story here. One of China's top economists, a man named Zhu Hengping, disappeared this week after having been arrested a few days earlier. And this is a famous economist. It would be almost like if Alan Greenspan or someone like that in the United States suddenly disappeared from the public eye. And the reason this happened to Zhu Hengping is because he had criticized China's economy in a private chat on WeChat. So he was talking to some trusted acquaintances in this private group and voicing his concerns about the deteriorating Chinese economy. And he probably thought he was safe since he was in a private group and among trusted friends. But the Chinese Communist Party, really, it's always listening and it's always spying one way or the other. And somehow Xi Jinping found out. And I think it's likely that we will never hear from Mr. Zhu again, just as has been the case with many influential Chinese citizens in recent years. Or there is also the chance that Mr. Zhu will reappear in a year or so, this time subdued. A good boy, towing the party line, China's number one, Xi Jinping is a god among men. You know, we've seen this kind of, you could call it ideological neutering, happen many times with Chinese elites in recent years. Send them off to a re-education camp for a couple of years, and then they reappear perfectly in line. The list that we've seen this happen with so far includes Jack Ma, one of China's most successful billionaires, also Fan Bingbing, the famous actress, really a megastar who vanished for a little while, and even Hu Jintao, the man who led China before Xi Jinping. So there's a chance we may never see Mr. Zhu again, but if he survives the torture and submits to his re-education program in a really contrite way, then maybe he'll pop back up in a few months or years.
Yeah, that really does stand out from this, from China, like how high profile the people were. Jack Ma came immediately to mind when you were talking. like the equivalent of Elon Musk or Jeff Bezos just disappearing for a couple of years and then living a quiet life thereafter where we're not even sure what kind of their status is. I mean, it feels like China is deliberately sending the message. It doesn't matter who you are. It doesn't matter how famous you are. We can get you. And it is kind of a terrifying picture. Like if even Jeff Bezos or China's Jeff Bezos or China's Alan Greenspan can't speak his mind, what hope do I have?
It's true. It's a very sobering picture. Xi Jinping has purged thousands, literally thousands of people from his government. And at this point, actually, one thing that caught my eye about this story, I didn't realize there was anyone even left to purge. I thought that he had been so thorough in his campaign to remove all dissent that everyone knew to keep their mouths shut. But here we have this economist and we see that the purge is not yet complete.
I guess, though, for him, the dangerous tipping point is if you purge so many people that people start to believe it's only a matter of time and I'll be next and I've got nothing to lose by trying to get rid of the guy.
It's a good point. And I've heard some China analysts who believe that China is near that point. And they'll say that China is already at a point where Xi Jinping has removed anyone who will give him any kind of truth. He has removed anyone but the most, you know, sycophantic yes men, just loyalists who tell him what he wants to hear. And that's not a good position for any leader to be in.
I think it's worth us spending a few minutes on that, because I think China is this terrifying look at the post-American world. And I say that as a non-American and as someone who has plenty of things to criticize about America. That fundamentally, though, the world that has been dominated by Britain and then America has valued things like free speech and rule of law, and they've not been implemented perfectly or completely consistently, but those have been dominant philosophies all over the globe. And those are philosophies that are right out of the Bible and come from these nations' histories with the Bible. And as America becomes weaker in the world, there are quite a lot of people that are cheering that. And I think China just shows what you can do, whether it's drones, whether it's video surveillance, whether it's monitoring private conversation, like that kind of dystopianism that we've seen throughout history, combined with technology that we have not seen at all throughout history, is pretty scary. And again, it gets back to this kind of theme of our upcoming trumpet print issue, that there isn't any hope in man. It's a dark world if you look at some of the trends going on right now. But you know, it's in the Bible and it's in God's plan for the world, and he's not going to let it kind of sink into this permanent dystopian 1984 style dictatorship of a human face underneath the sole of a boot forever. He's got a plan, and those biblical values are going to be back. God's law is going to be covering the earth as the water covers the sea, and it's going to be a world far more wonderful than anything that we've seen ever in man's history. Well, thank you for that, Jeremiah. So I understand from the mainstream media that we have some very good news, really, to talk about from the United States today for our main story there. So NBC News this week, murder and other violent crimes dropped across USA last year, FBI data shows. And just on this subject from across the summer, ABC News, U.S. stats show violent crime dramatically falling. And then they say, so why is there a rising clash with perception? Another NBC News headline from earlier in the summer, FBI stats show historic decline in violent crime rate, with murder showing sharpest drop. So, Andrew, I believe you wanted to talk about this story. Are you going to tell us about what a wonderful, peaceful place the United States now is?
Well, definitely not our big cities. Like I said, that rising clash in perception you're talking about is going to be a huge issue this election cycle. Opinion polls routinely show that immigration and inflation are the top two issues Americans are concerned about. But rising crime is not far beyond that. Biden's let 10 million illegal immigrants into the nation. Venezuelan gangs are coming into Aurora, Colorado, the south side of Chicago, New York City, starting turf wars with the normal gangs that have been here for years. And people are really concerned about the crime. Now, The media, which traditionally aligns with the Democratic Party and wants to make it look like Biden and Harris is doing a good job, have really been trumpeting for weeks now that violent crime is coming down. Even in the presidential debate, Donald Trump said it was going up, and the Harris didn't even have to disagree with him because the ABC fact checkers jumped in and said that it's like, no, actually, the statistics show that crime is going down. The FBI finally released its a report this week and said that violent crime has gone down 3% since last year. So we're in a really interesting situation where actually the Justice Department measures violent crime in two ways. And the two ways it measures violent crime are at dramatic opposites with each other right now. So Trump and the Republicans are talking about one measuring statistic, and the Democrats and the mainstream media are talking about the other. But the two ways is the FBI report is they report on crime reported by police officers. And so when the FBI tells you that violent crime is going down, they're saying the police reported 3% less violent crimes this year than last year. The second way that the same Justice Department, the FBI is part of the Justice Department, that the same Justice Department reports crime is a victimization survey, where instead of relying on their police reports, they actually use surveying of the actual people in the United States to say, like, have you been the victim of any violent crimes in the past 12 months? And then extrapolate that data. That victimization survey says that violent crime is up 55% since Biden took office. So half over, like, is however many crimes took place the last year of Donald Trump's year, take half of that and add that on top. Half over again is many. So that's a pretty big discrepancy. It's the same Justice Department that they're, the survey they take asking the people, have you been subject to a violent crime, says up 55%. The survey they actually asked the police said, well, it's about down about 3%. And so there's actually a really easy way to reconcile that. And the Wall Street Journal, which is a pretty mainstream newspaper, honestly did some reporting on this. As they said, well, they said since the, they have something in American law enforcement we're now calling the Ferguson effect. There was a bad race riot in Ferguson a few years ago, where the it was a white police officer hurt a black criminal, and the media backlash against the police was so bad that the police didn't want anything like that to happen again. So they just pulled back from some of these neighborhoods. And you're seeing that, and that trend got worse after the George Floyd protest. And it's getting worse, like as you get these Venezuelan gangs move into New York, as they move into Chicago. There are parts of the south side of Chicago where, like, the police, they don't even want to go there anymore. I think in Europe, they call them no-go zones, and they're more about Islamists. But there's with the gangs, there's that trend here. So it makes sense that if, like, the crime's getting bad enough that the police don't go into that neighborhood, then when the Justice Department surveys you and be like, how is the violent crime in your neighborhood? You're like, worse than ever. It's like, I've been subject to like three assaults this year. But then if they ask the local police department in that neighborhood, they're like, well, how many arrests have you made for violent crimes? They're like, oh, like, not very many. We don't even go there anymore.
It's such a powerful example of how the media lies while giving the letter of the truth. I just spent a couple of minutes before this show gathering headlines. I just went to Google and was, you know, typed in something about like US crime rate news or whatever. And I didn't search very hard to find those headlines. That was just the first one that came up. I didn't see a single headline that gave the context that you just told us. Nothing about that in any of those articles. And again, I just skimmed to kind of have an introduction rather than to research this subject deeply. But most people, like if you're just generally keeping an eye on the news, you're never going to see any of that. And so, you know, that's important. But also, this rising crime rate, I mean, this is a curse. This is a result of our own behavior. This is a sign that we're doing something, that America is doing something badly wrong as a nation, that things are moving in a wrong direction. And it's a problem that was prophesied.
Yeah, because there's two main results of our own behavior. There's, because if you look at the south side of Chicago, there was actually a former gang member there who did an interview with the media this week where he was talking about. He said there's these black gangs that have like run this south side of Chicago for decades. And he said the crime rate's about to get a lot worse because now you've got these Venezuelan gangs who have recently entered the country. And so you're basically on a race war in Chicago, on the verge of a race war between blacks and Hispanics as they both try to take over these crime networks. Now, these black gangs, that's not new, and they're not all black, but they're predominantly black in that part of Chicago, have been there for years. And the sociologists at like the Heritage Foundation and other places say that they pretty much can predict the crime in a neighborhood within about a 10% margin of error by plugging fatherlessness into an equation. They said it's like, since if the fatherlessness is this much, then they've got an equation that adjusts for several factors. But they said we can give you a pretty rough estimate of what the crime's going to be like without knowing anything else. And so a lot of this is just due to like decades of family breakdown in America. For a myriad of reasons, the family breakdown in Chicago has been worse amongst the black community than the white community. And so that's the main reason, like the family breakdown is the root cause of that gang violence you're seeing in Chicago and other cities. But now there's a new wrinkle been introduced to it where Biden's let all these immigrants coming in from other nations. And so now you've got like gangs that have traditionally been operating in Venezuela who they've just led into the country. And now they want to control the crime networks in Chicago. And so, but to do that, they've got to beat out the gangs that have already been there for years. And so you're getting like almost like drug cartel warfare in Mexico as they fight this out. And it doesn't make sense that in a neighborhood like that, that like, oh, crime's going down. You're like, crime never goes down when you introduce a brand new gang from a foreign country. You have to fight a turf war. And so these are curses prophesied in the Bible. I think one scripture that we use oftentimes in dealing with this is actually in Isaiah 1 verse 7. And the lead up to that is God lamenting over end time Israel turning away from him, where he says that like, well, an ox knows its owner and a donkey knows its owner, but Israel doesn't look at me as a father anymore. And so this is in particularly in the concept of Israel no longer looking at God as their father, but that he's bringing a family element into it here that shows that by the time you get to verse 7, it says, your cities are burned with fire, devoured by strangers. And actually a lot of the more, that's from the King James Version. Some of the more modern translations even update the language stranger to aliens. And so this is about riots and burning and crime, specifically in America's cities being perpetrated mostly by aliens. And for years that a lot of the crime there has been amongst well, racial minorities, predominantly people who aren't necessarily ethnic Israelites, but still American citizens. But now more recently, you're actually getting like aliens in the fact that they're not just not descended from ancient Israel, but aliens in the fact that they're like, actually were in Venezuela 12 months ago and are now coming in and burning down. We're expecting Donald Trump to come back this election, but it's like, even if he comes back, I think Chicago's going to be in a bad spot, because it's like, whether you try to deport these Venezuelan immigrants or whatnot, it's going to be a big fight to try to get them as these turf wars. And you see that in Mexico, that like when the Sinaloa cartel and the Gulf cartel go at each other for a certain market, it gets really bloody for a while.
So what we're seeing is a direct result of efforts to bring America down, both that effort to bring America down and all of these, the results, all of these curses, those are both prophesied. And those are all something that you can read about in our free book, America Under Attack. And you have a few other stories you wanted to bring us that also tie into key prophetic trends for the United States.
Yeah, well, we've been talking about violence and media lies, and another big story in America where both those trends, violence and media lies, intersect. Is there Scott Rasmussen, who's a very famous pollster in America. He did a pretty wide-ranging television survey of likely voters and found that 28% of Democrats believe America would be better off or would have been better off if Donald Trump would have died during one of the two assassination attempts. And so it's almost a certain that there will be more assassination attempts on Donald Trump's life. Now, for prophetic reasons, from Amos 7 and verse 8 in 2 Kings 14, God talks about using a Trump-like figure to save America temporarily. So we're definitely coming down dogmatic that those assassination attempts will not be successful, but there's good indication that more of them will happen. They also found another story that nothing should shock me anymore, but this kind of shocked me a little bit. But the Ryan Roth, who's the most recent Trump assassin, who's talking about how America would be so much better if Trump was assassinated. His son was just arrested on childhood pornography charges. And so this shows you the moral caliber of the people who says that America would be better off if Trump was dead. They're not the type of people who being like, well, I have to commit a murder so that he doesn't destroy the nation. It's like this family is literally trafficking child pornography and then self-righteously talking about how Trump is the problem with America. And then one other story, one last story I'll just bring to your attention that's similar about people pointing to the wrong problems is the U.S. Army. They finally admitted that they've trained at least 9,000 soldiers, actually more than 9,000 soldiers, with PowerPoint presentations that explicitly list several pro-life groups in the United States as terrorist organizations. So even in the military, they're coming out and saying that if you're against abortion, you're a terrorist. So they're very much like, don't worry about the actual Venezuelan terrorists getting ready to burn down Chicago because crime's coming down. Just take our word for it. You need to be focusing on people who say don't abort your babies because they could be dangerous in the future.
Thank you very much for that, Andrew. That is about it for today's Trumpet World. I'll mention again that book, The King of the South. There's a lot of different material that we reference on this show. If one of them has piqued your interest, I'd encourage you to scroll down into the show notes and we'll try and link to everything that we mentioned there so you can find that easily. But if that's kind of too much to take in, you can't read all of that, I will point you to The King of the South as being your guide to understanding the most important news that's going on right now in the Middle East. And you can get that at our website, thetrumpet.com. All of our material is free. You can read it for free online. We'll ship it to you for free. There are no shipping fees. There's no follow-up questions. There's no bugging you for donations or to come attend church services with us or anything like that. We just send you the book. We'll be very happy to do that. And we said we've got all of our other things like our email lists, our Trumpet print magazines, all of those on our website, thetrumpet.com. Well, thank you to our guests for joining me today. Thank you to George Haddad and Isaac Lorenz for engineering and production. You can email the show at trumpetworld@thetrumpet.com. Till then, keep watching your world.